talking about? Yeah.
Enjoy it while it lasts. Gambling gods, fickle bunch.
Oh, yeah.
So easily offended.
Uh-huh. I tell you, there might be businesses you could make more than $2 million in a weekend. But will somebody tell me, somebody please tell me, where else you're going to have this much fucking fun?
You the man. You the man, Big Papa.
Tuesday, December 25, 2018. This is The Better Life. I am your host, Timothy Lawson. That clip at the top of the show comes from a movie with Matthew McConaughey and Al Pacino. It's called Two for the Money. It's about sports betting. And with today's guest being a professional sports bettor, I thought it was appropriate to play a clip from that show. My favorite part of that is Jeremy Piven saying the gambling gods are a fickle bunch. Yeah, they are. Yeah, they are. I did really well in weeks one and two of the NFL, and then slid into week three getting punched in the face every step of the way. I followed someone on USC, didn't work out. Followed another friend on TCU, didn't work out. Went into the NFL games with my own picks. I liked Green Bay, didn't work out. Had a Rams Pats teaser. Thought it was going to be okay, and then the Pats can't pull it off. Didn't work out. 0-4 on the weekend, and anybody who's been betting long enough knows you just get some of those sometimes. So hopefully that is a rare occasion for me this season. The Patreon subscribers should have seen a audio clip yesterday where I give my thoughts on the week four lines, which lines I think look good, which games I'd consider teasing, and then the couple games that I will absolutely be staying away from a survivor pool perspective. That's right, because I am still continuing a survivor pool. For those of you that did not see the tweet yesterday, I am starting a survivor pool part deux. That's part two for those who don't speak French. If you go to thebetterlife.us/merch, you'll find a page there at my very underdeveloped site. But there's a item there called Survivor Reviver Buy-In. That is for anybody to use. You can go there. It's $6. $4.50 will be going to this. It will be going to the pool. $1 will be going to our charity, which is Canine for Warriors, and then 50 cents will cover the transaction charge that my online store will charge me for that transaction. But this is a little easier to manage for me than the donations were. So I appreciate everybody using this as for the new buy-in. We already got a handful of people in. Anybody can use this. If you were in the survivor pool that completely got wrecked by week three, by the way, we only have two people left in that group. One person picked the Bears, stuck around. One other person picked the Chiefs, stuck around. Everybody else, Vikings, Jaguars, Patriots, all went down in flames. So two people left in the original group of 30. And I am taking entrance for this pool pretty much until kickoff of Thursday night football. So that is your window. You have a couple days, but kickoff is around 8:30 Eastern Standard Time, probably 7 p.m. EST, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursday is when I will no longer be inviting entrance into the second survivor pool. Just be sure that when you do enter the new survivor pool, that when you go into your picks, that you have the new group. It's called Chasing Losses, because that's what we're doing, right? The new group called Chasing Losses. Make sure you have that one selected so you can make a pick, because otherwise it may not let you make a pick, because if you were already in the group that lost, it may think that you're out of it, but if you go to the group Chasing Losses, it'll see that particular group doesn't start till week four, and it'll let you make your pick. So thebetterlife.us/merch is where you can find the Survivor Reviver buy-in, $6. If the email address that you use to complete that purchase is different for some reason from the email address you want to be invited to, DM me on Twitter or email me or some other fashion, or ping me. Let me know that you have another email address that you want used. This past weekend, I did a little free play roundup. I had free play available to me at three different casinos in the area. So I made a day of it. Well, I guess I didn't make a day of it, but I made sure I hit them all in one day. In the morning, I ran over to MGM National Harbor, and I got it was a spin the wheel, spin the virtual wheel type thing, right? So who knows how random that was, but I got $25 of free play, I think, and I turned that into $20. That was nice. And then went up to, and I say it's nice because the minimum was 10. And I feel like anytime you go for like this, like random free play, anytime you get more than the minimum, it feels like a huge victory, doesn't it? It's like, you know, up, you know, at least $10. And you're like, all right, well, this is probably gonna be $10. And you get 15. You're like, ha, beat that randomization. I got 15 instead of your stupid minimum 5. No, so this time I got 25. Felt like a huge victory. Turned it into 20 playing some 9-5 jacks or better. And then later that day, I went to Maryland Live where I had a coupon. So this was interesting. Maryland Live sent out coupons that you just entered into the slot machine and it just gave you an amount. Now, I'm sure the coupon was a predetermined amount. I understand that was probably the case. But there was no indicator on the coupon how much you might have. You didn't have to go to a promotions kiosk. You didn't have to go to the counter. They sent you a coupon. You put it in, and then boom, you were just credited a certain amount of money. Now, this is where I got the minimum. I got five whole dollars at Maryland Live on this coupon. I played max spin. Now, I asked someone at the counter before. I was like, hey, will this work in a video poker machine? And she said no. Now, she didn't say it with enough conviction for me to believe that that may have been true, but I didn't want to accidentally put it in a video poker machine, have it not work, and then maybe not get my coupon back, right? So I went to a slot machine. I put it in. I don't remember what I was even playing. It was some ridiculous name. My wife was with me. We chose a slot machine with just the most ridiculous name and design. We sat down, put it in, got $5. Max spin, got $375 back, cashed out, kept moving. I had a match play coupon, $15 match play. Found a blackjack table with an empty seat, sat down, put my match play down, got dealt a 20, won that hand, bounced. We moved on to Horseshoe Baltimore. Now this is what I love about Horseshoe Baltimore is they really pile on the promotions for Diamond members. It seems like, I went there. And what did I get? I had $55 in direct bet off one promotion. And then I had another promotion that gave me the option between $90 in direct bet or 9,000 reward credits. Well, since I don't have a Vegas trip coming up soon, I have a lot of rewards credits for what I use. You know, like I only use them like a couple times a month when like to bring the wife to get something to eat. So I took the direct bet there too. So I had, what, $145 in direct bet? Sort of wandering around the casino, thinking about how I'm going to play this. So I first started sat down at a Baccarat table, 25 and 25. what was nice about the direct bet, so it printed out in different levels of value, right? So $10, $10, $10, $10, $25, $25, right? So, and I think there was one $5, there was one $50, but what's nice is I could stack the coupons, right? So I went to a Baccarat table that was $25 and I used my two tens and my five, right? So I used three coupons to get to $25 and that was fine. So I liked that. First hand, got a nat eight win. Second hand, I actually put two coupons out plus a $5 chip because I was trying to preserve my coupons as best possible. That one lost. Okay, moved on to Pai Gow. Now, this is where I could really see value in using these direct bet coupons at casinos where alcohol is comped. We all love Pai Gow because it is a push and drink game, right? Well, imagine that push and drink game being done with little pieces of paper that isn't technically your money, but still can get you money should they go in your favor. And so I sat down with my $25 coupons and played some Pai Gow, and had plenty of pushes, and I think I played three hands. I want to say I played three hands, and I won two. Maybe? I don't know. I can't quite remember if I played two hands and won one or if I played three hands and won two. And then I had my $50 coupon. And, of course, I let math get to the best of me on this one. I was like, well, I guess I should play blackjack. So I found a 3-2 to put table. I put my $50. And so I guess I should say, before I sit on the blackjack table, I was really considering letting the wife choose between red or black and putting it down on one of those and having this, like, but I let the math inform me a little too much on this. And I was like, in my head, I was like, still conflicted. I was like, I guess I should do this on a better bet than that. And so I put it on the blackjack table. I got dealt a 17. The dealer had an 8, and I was like, well, so much for this. And then the dealer drew to 21, which was a punch in the gut for me and everybody else. I imagine someone at the table was looking at me with a side eye with, like, this guy sits down, puts his, like, one coupon down. We all lose on this draw to 21. And in hindsight, I realized, you know, I think next time if I had that same situation where I have these, like, all these different denomination coupons, I'm just going to let the big one ride on rule, especially if I'm going to play through all the small ones. And if there is success in those, if I lose them all, I'm probably going to stick to to where the math is. But, I think I won just under half of what it would have offered, which is fine, right? I had 145. I must have had somewhere around 70. I didn't win the $50 one. So I had right around 90. So I had about $40 to $50 I had won so far. And so I felt pretty good about it. I probably should just put the roulette one, like, put it down a roulette and, like, have that fun of, like, the ball spinning and the little, like, last little suspense on how's this gonna swing on this direct bet promotion. So, but what's great is I'll have plenty of opportunities to do that, because right now Horseshoe Baltimore is sending me promotions. Each month I'm getting an email about how in the first half of the month and in the second half of the month, I have the option between $90 direct bet and $9,000 reward credits, which comes to about $90 when you apply it to food and beverage. So, and I plan on taking advantage of every one of those. They're sending those out. They're sending, like, random, like, hey, you also get X amount of dollars in direct bet, or you also get X amount of reward credits just for logging into a slot machine. And then they also have gift giveaways. I mean, and they're doing this with I think I've given them play twice this entire year, right? And I think it's just my diamond status that's getting these promotions. It's pretty incredible. But that's, other than a horrible weekend in sports and rounding up the free play, that's about all the gambling I have to report on. This week's show is with Preston Johnson. Preston Johnson is a professional sports bettor. I became aware of him through his work with Gil Alexander. He's been on a numbers game a bunch of times. He's on during the football season. He is on Friday mornings on a numbers game with Gil Alexander. They do a 3-on-3 picking college football. The college football is one of his main sports. Preston's going to talk to us about how he got into poker, and then how Black Friday kind of pushed him in the direction of sports betting, and how he started becoming good at that, how it's worked into his life with not only his family but his religion. Very interesting conversation, and one that was great to have as we go into the heart of football season. Enjoy. All right. Well, Preston, you're with fantasygurualite.com. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct.
All right. And you are at Sports Cheetah on Twitter. Preston Johnson, professional sports bettor. Sir, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
We don't know each other, but I'm very familiar with you. I'm a friend of Gil Alexander, therefore I follow a lot of what he does, and you've made appearances on some of his products, not only VSIN, but I believe you've been on Beating the Book at one point, if I remember right. So it's a pleasure to finally get around to talking to you. We are going to start this where we start a lot of these interviews, and that's going all the way back to when we were first exposed to gambling. So maybe not even when you first started making bets, but like maybe you saw someone playing poker, maybe you saw something on TV, whatever. If you remember that your earliest exposure to gambling, what was it?
Yeah, I imagine my earliest exposure is pretty similar to a lot of people's that are gambling in any way or form now is so I was in high school, but 2003, the big poker boom with Chris Moneymaker, ESPN started showing the World Series of Poker more regularly on their telecast. And then they also had the whole card invention, so you could actually see the people's cards. So I started playing poker back then in high school. And I think if it wasn't for, I'd like to at least think that if I was not very successful at that, I wouldn't be gambling. But I was fortunate enough back then when I started playing, I was winning. And so I kept playing, and then kind of everything went from there. But I was, originally just playing house games with friends for $5 or $10. But the first time when I turned 18, where I grew up near Los Angeles, they have a few Indian casinos around where you only have to be 18 to play. I played my first tournament and it wasn't like a ton, but there's quite a few players, but it was only like $150 buy-in, but which was a lot for a 18-year-old in high school. But I ended up getting third. And so I kind of, the first time I had like thousands of dollars in my hand at one time, it was a big deal. And so I went from there. I ended up, depositing a good portion online and playing a lot online. And my biggest, I guess, claim to fame is in a Sunday tournament on PokerStars. I got a third place, pretty big cash. And I was playing mostly cash games, but I'd play tournaments occasionally on Sundays there. And so that was kind of where my first initial just betting, gambling, anything originated. And I loved sports growing up. And I'm sure we'll get into more details on that, whether I played some, which I did, but I also studied it in college. Sports psychology is where my master's degree is. And so kind of when Black Friday happened and poker got banned online in the United States, it was kind of this natural segue into, well, you need to keep gambling and you have this bankroll from cards. Might as well bet on sports. And so that's when I kind of picked up sports, probably been almost 11 years now.
Okay. So what was your Black Friday scenario? I know some people like myself, our deposits hadn't fully gone through, and so we got saved. Some people were left with thousands of dollars that they had to wait for the buyout and then the refund. Where were you in that scenario?
Yeah, so I had money at Full Tilt and PokerStars, and PokerStars was resolved pretty quickly, and there was less weirdness going on there. The money that was at Full Tilt took, I think, just until about 2 years ago, people finally got their money back from Full Tilt. It took that long to figure out the settlements. But I had a pretty good amount over, like, kind of divvied up between the two. But I had more at PokerStars, which was fortunate. I was also lucky to be in a spot where I didn't need the money to, pay bills. And I was still going to school. I was kind of living like a student anyways, even though I had, like, this $50,000 bankroll from poker. I was still, eating really cheap and going to school and wanted to finish my degrees and stuff. And so I wasn't really in a dire need to grab that. So I wasn't really affected as fully as I know some people that were just doing it full time. And when they, some friends of mine that couldn't play anymore, they either had to move out of the country. I know some that moved to Mexico and Canada or moved to Vegas to play in person full time. So for me, it was kind of like, well, I guess I just can't play poker anymore, kind of as the side job while I go to school, and just actually probably helped me focus on school, to be honest, more often than I was previously.
It sounds like what happened on Black Friday was sort of the catalyst into your sports betting career. Like, had you done any betting on sports until then? Like, were you familiar enough with it enough to make the transition, or did you have a lot of learning to do?
I hadn't really done much outside of, like, parlays randomly with friends for fun, really, like, low stakes. Just usually it was driving to Vegas for March Madness and maybe betting during the weekend is like the one time of year I would actually be placing bets. So there definitely was a pretty big learning curve as far as gathering, I guess, what I could do, as far as betting. And I guess a lot of things are similar. This is what I'm getting at is with poker, one of the main things outside of being able to determine your edge and actually find an edge and bet it is managing your bankroll and being able to do it profitably. And I'd already kind of learned that from the previous years through cards. And so that applied pretty simply. It was just a matter of now figuring out what to bet on and be profitable doing it. And fortunately, I guess my background in college and stuff, I did psychology, but I was really the kid that was, you know, the perfect score on the math section of the SAT and really math oriented and analytical. And I was able to just kind of pick up the number side and make projections and model some different sports from the get-go and then adjust on the fly and figure out and learning from other people as well. And then eventually actually kind of becoming like a Twitter presence and learning from other people on Twitter with this whole gambling Twitter kind of audience now that we have and using that information to my ability. So I'd say it probably took a good 2 years before I was comfortable betting a reasonable amount, but it was pleasant because I didn't really just like lose a ton of money the first year or anything because the bankroll management was already there. And it was more just kind of learning the processes of making more profitable bets, when to enter the market, how much I can get down where, and kind of how to go about just the organization of it all.
And I like that you emphasize so much on bankroll management as sort of the leading discipline into being confident that you could succeed because, if you only listened to sports betting Twitter, you would think that simply being able to pick games would be your the rate of your success, right? But it's really bankroll management, not only being selective on when you get down, but how much you get down, understanding true value. That's the one thing that I have always, as good as I get with bankroll management, the one thing that I have the biggest challenge with is being able to understand when I have more value, right? Like when, like sure. Game A, I like game A, game B, I like game B. I always have a tough time of knowing that, hey, game B has more value than game A, therefore it warrants a slightly larger bet. How did you learn that? Or I guess maybe, you know, you said it took you a couple of years to get comfortable. Was that a skill that was also coming in that evolution?
Yeah, so that's essentially the skill of being able to quantify your edge. And so if you, like a really simple example, we'll say for college football this weekend, say, what's a game early? Like Friday night, I think USC, they host Washington State. Current line's -3.5. If your projection's more like 7, you know, then that's going to represent an edge worth, you know, say it's about like a 5 or 6% edge. It's a pretty big one, right? If that's the discrepancy that you see in your perceived true line of 7, you believe in, you know, wholeheartedly. And so that's going to warrant, you know, if you're doing any type of like Kelly criterion betting or just kind of your own setup where, you know, when you have an edge of 5 to 7%, you're betting this much per game. If you have one from 3 or 4%, you're betting this much. You know, if it's a 1 or 2% edge, then you should be betting smaller. It makes sense too. Like if you have a bigger edge on a bet or a game, whatever it is, then the more money you can get down on it, the better. And if you have smaller edges, they're still worth betting, then you should be betting smaller amounts. And so the idea is to try to maximize your profitability long-term and your ultimate, you know, ROI. And so learning that definitely takes time. And the key part being, you know, like you were saying, being able to actually quantify the edge and knowing that when you think USC should be -7 and it's -3.5, one, that you think it's a good bet, and two, you know, how much to actually risk on it. And so that's part of learning experience. There's some math and stuff involved too, but it's ultimately, you know, one of the, you know, many variables that go into this game of trying to, you know, beat the odds makers and actually be profitable betting the sports.
Do you, and I, you know, I don't want you to give away all your secrets. I know there's a lot of proprietary stuff that comes into your success, but a theme in some of my recent episodes is going to be tracking your betting. And I know that's important because you can only manage what you measure. I imagine this probably even goes back to your poker days. If you do so, how detailed do you go into tracking your success?
Yeah, so I think one of the more important things for people to learn that are trying to get more serious with this is even beyond tracking your success in the sense of how much you won or lost, but you want to track your success and your bets because, I mean, even for over the course of a season, 2 seasons, or just a week or 2 weeks, anything can happen. You could have the best bets in the world. You could be laying -3.5s that close -10 and still lose those bets. Over the long term, you know, in a vacuum, those are going to be profitable bets. So I think the key is for someone that's tracking and wanting to see really if their bets are profitable and supposed to be profitable is tracking when you place the bets and then what the closing line is at the end of the week or right before kickoff and being able to gauge from there, okay, well, if I'm betting -3.5 and it's closing 5.5 or 6, then that's going to be a, you know, plus EV, you know, it's a positive equity value every time I'm making a bet like that. And that's what you're looking for ultimately, even if the bet loses, is you want to make sure that it was at least a sound bet in that regard, because ultimately this still is gambling, right? Anything can happen, especially in a one game sample. It's another reason why you'll see overreactions early in seasons. I think I saw something even just with like NFL yesterday. Dogs were like 10-3 or something against the spread, I believe, 9-3, something in that range. And so you'll see a lot of overreactions just after 1 or 2 weeks. USC, I think, is an overreaction to how bad they've played. It early showed they've played the first couple weeks of the season. But as far as tracking goes, you should absolutely be looking, and you have accounts. If you're actually betting money, you'll have it kind of tracked in the accounts. But set up a spreadsheet, you know, write in where it was when you bet it, -3.5. If it closes, you know, USC pick, then that's a pretty bad bet. And I could end up, you know, looking really poor on this podcast later this week. It totally could happen. And so those are the types of things you should be looking for, even outside of the win loss, is when you're making bets and then relative to where they close in the market before kickoff or tip off if you're doing basketball or whatever.
The lines matter so much, right? And, you know, one thing I remember Gil harps on his show, A Numbers Game, is, you know, being a sharp bettor is one who frequently or more times than not beats the closing line, right? It's the rate in which you can beat the closing line and what really defines a sharp bettor, which really gets lost, especially now that sports betting's legalized and everybody's using sharp, square, you know, wise guy, all those terms. Yeah. Public, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, a sharp bettor is one who at a high rate or a decent rate can beat the closing line. And it's so, you know, this past weekend, week two of the NFL, when I saw the opener on the Texans Titans game at Pick'em, I really liked the Texans. I wanted to get action down on that. I don't live in a state that allows that, and so I didn't get an opportunity to get action on it until later in the week. And when I finally got an opportunity to, it was already at 3.5, and I was like, well, even if I liked it, like that's 3 points of negative equity, right? Like that I would have lost there. So I ultimately stayed off the game, which ended up being a positive. Staying off the game was a positive EV play, and not taking that loss. How often, if at all, do you look for opportunities for middling and scalping?
Yeah, that might have been one, for example. I was actually on the opposite side, and so it's not a great example here, maybe ultimately. But, you know, if you bet pick and you think it should be -2 or 2.5 and you like Houston pick, plus Mariota was questionable, he might not play, you know, then later on taking +3.5, I mean, that's absolutely something you could do if you think both plays are, you know, positive EV plays. For me, I thought the Titans should have been a short favorite if Mariota played. Then it came out later in the week, I think Friday, that two offensive linemen got injured, or maybe it was even Saturday. So that lane jumped from even the 1.5 twos up to 3. Then Mariota didn't play. It was Blaine Gabbert. And so then you even saw 3.5 on Sunday. So I took a bad number. I took 2.5 actually earlier in the week. Wound up being a bad number because Mariota and the two linemen didn't play. But I think there's definitely those opportunities. And after seeing the first half, I believe Tennessee, if you recall, Tim, they had that crazy fake punt where no one was really guarding the guy on the bottom of the screen. He was wide open, so they threw it, and he just ran probably a good 60 to 65 yards for a touchdown. And if you looked at the first half stats, yards per play, and, you know, Titans kind of got that fluky TD and then had another drive set up from a turnover. And I believe it was a 14-7 at halftime, I believe. So I actually bet Texans second half because, one, it was an opportunity for me to get out of a bad bet I had made before the game on +2.5 because I thought Mariota was going to play, and I had made the bet before the two offensive linemen were injured on Saturday. So I was able to get out of it. Plus, it set up this middling opportunity betting Texans -3 second half, where as long as, you know, if the Titans could win the game, or, you know, Texans could come back, lose the game by 4-3-2-1, I actually win both bets, which luckily is what happened. The Titans ended up kicking a field goal to win, and the Texans actually won the second half by 4. So there's definitely opportunities like that that'll present themselves throughout the season, whether it be on the same game before kickoff completely or even live in game. I'm always looking to bet second half stuff when it, you know, the opportunity presents itself.
So when it comes to, and you can measure this however you'd like, but can you compare your pregame action to your in-game action?
Sure. Yeah. So it varies by league quite a bit. I bet a lot more in-game in basketball. I'm not sure if that's just because I'm more comfortable or it's a preference. I think there's a lot more opportunity because the runs in basketball are so drastic, or droughts in basketball are so drastic, whether you're betting overs or unders or just sides. Live basketball, there's a ton of opportunity. And I think you can also narrow down, and I'm able to measure based on rotations and who's subbing out when, kind of what lines should be at that point in the game. And so I think maybe I'm just better at live betting basketball in that regard. It's tougher to recognize when one defensive back goes out, you know, how much that player is really worth to the team as a whole, and then live betting accordingly. Whereas basketball, you kind of have this set thing where, okay, I know Steph Curry is going to be on the bench for the next 7.5 minutes to 8 minutes and X, right? So there's opportunity to do things. I think in basketball that I'm probably betting more live basketball than before, like full game bets in general. Whereas football, I'm probably betting about twice as much before the game start as I am live.
Gotcha. Okay. So you just mentioned basketball possibly being more comfortable with that. We know you bet college football. What are some other sports or leagues that you find yourself getting betting sort of throughout the entire season?
Yeah, college football is my biggest league that I'll bet from a bankroll standpoint, or from just people that have followed me for over the years that know that's kind of my bread and butter, so to speak. I just had mentioned that for in-game, I think at basketball offers more opportunity, which is true. But from a league sense, I would say college football is my best and biggest. Those are correlated, right? Like if it's your best league, it should be the one you're betting the biggest. And if it isn't, then you probably shouldn't be betting as much. Like for the NFL, which I do bet the NFL, my edge is a lot smaller. I mean, NFL is really sharp. And I think 4 last 5 seasons have been winning seasons, but they're pretty small winning seasons. And then the losing season was a pretty small losing season. Like it's pretty tough to really just have this massive, you know, like 65% NFL season, and with the volume being a lot less because lines are so much better in the NFL anyways, and odds makers just have them right. A lot of the same players, only 30 something teams rather than 130. It's definitely tougher. So you kind of vary your bet sizing dependent on league. At least that's what I do. Similar to, you know, trying to quantify your edge within one game, varying your bet sizing. I think you should do the same within leagues, whether you're betting futures or season win totals or games or in game. That's all kind of all encompassing. But for me, it's both football leagues, both basketball leagues, Major League Baseball. I bet through June, and then I drop everything at that point for two reasons. One, initially being on purpose so that I could just do all my football preparation. I need a couple months to get ready for football season. Then it was also really nice because the NBA finals just end at the beginning of June too, to actually kind of feel like I have a break every year. I think it's really healthy and positive to have basically what ends up being about a month and a half where I'm just not betting just about nothing other than, you know, futures bets for college football, basically, which is really nice. So for me, it's a little bit of baseball. I'll jump it back in during playoffs some, but mostly football, basketball, baseball. And I don't do hockey or tennis or golf or MMA. There's a lot of those niche leagues and sports other guys out there can crush, but I've never really had the time to dive into them.
I'm curious about, you know, this is the better life, and, you know, the life of a gambler is just a little different than those who don't gamble. And I think one of the things, right, is we have this either, whether it be a hobby or a profession or recreation or whatever it is in our lives, you know, it's viewed as a vice, right? It's viewed as a huge level of risk. And I'm curious what your family's thoughts, either your immediate family when you were maybe in college or in high school and you're getting into poker, or even now as your sports betting brings in a large amount of your income, what your family's thoughts has been on your involvement in gambling.
Sure. I'm not sure if you know my background enough. This is a very intriguing question specifically for me. So you may or may not know some of this already, and maybe that's why you asked or not. But
sure.
I So I'm LDS or Mormon for people that are familiar with that religion. So I'm very religious. I still practice. I still go to church with my wife and kids every Sunday. I grew up Mormon with my parents, and gambling would be something, and betting in general would be something that's generally frowned upon. As far as the church goes, I think the main reason is because of a lot of the things that are equated or at least associated with gambling, right? And I think it's positive, right? You don't want people to get addicted to gambling. You don't want them playing poker or betting on sports or whatever table games they might play, because one, you could lose money, but it can eventually, you know, wreck a family. It could lead to whether it be drinking or smoking drugs, stuff, you know, in Las Vegas. It's just really pertinent. And so I think it's a positive thing. I feel like, so I'm kind of, you know, arguing for their side, right? But I'm doing the opposite. So it's tough. I've kind of been this like little pull where I'm in the middle, and I'm maybe not, you know, 100% honest with everyone, you know, around me and I'm associated with in that regard. But I try to just look at it as, you know, a stockbroker would, that's, you know, investing in the stock market, the finance guy or bankers and stuff, that, you know, this is a similar market in some ways. And if you have an edge and you're profitable, and then I have really fortunate opportunity to create content and have some other solid income on the side, whether it be via podcasts or writing articles and stuff. And so having that, I mean, overall, and being able to, you know, make what I do and provide for families, been fine. And I, you know, as far as other people are concerned, you know, at this point, it's not like they're, well, you're going to lose all your money. I mean, at this point, I think I've kind of like solidified that I can do this.
Right.
So I haven't had too much backlash ultimately, but it definitely is kind of this kind of inner struggle still sometimes, though, within, you know, a church or community where you have this guy that I even like, there was someone that goes to my church that like saw a video I made a couple of years ago talking about a BYU Michigan State game, I think. And he's like, so how long have you been like this sports cheetah guy? And I was like, oh, great. So now I explain what I'm doing. So in all places of the world, not to get like too political in general, or not political, but just in like, I think a lot of religions are just communities in whatever thing that you do. Like there's a lot of judgment. And especially I think in like church culture where people are really conservative and you do anything wrong and it's like, whoa, wait a second. So I'm kind of more shy and I guess partly embarrassed, right? Where I've had to try to become a little more open about it. And that's why I don't mind actually talking about it now, because it's something I've had to kind of create. I've created a barrier in the past and like push it away and be like, I'm fine doing this. I'm confident in what I do. And I've, you know, made money. I feel like I'm still a good person. And regardless, I still think Jesus is a good person. Like I'm not going to not go to church. So those things I'm able to kind of accept and do, but it definitely was more of a struggle early on for sure.
Yeah. So then sort of tying this into what we were a little bit with talking about, you know, when you decided to bet, to take on sports betting and you sure. know, it took you a couple of years to like really get into it. When you finally decide, I guess the first question in the sequence is what were you seeing in your, when you were tracking it, we were saying two levels of success, right? Not only the money you're taking in, but how you're beating the closing line. Was it a combination of both, or was it one or the other? Like what gave you the signal? Like, okay, I'm good at this. I can do this professionally.
Yeah. I think I ran really good early. So I think that was really fortunate. And what I mean by run good, just, I was very, I was lucky in a lot of cases. So first couple of seasons I did college football, I was hitting like 60% or a little higher, which is pretty hard to do at the volume and not sustainable. And it's kind of been humbling. Like last year I had my first basically break even / losing season. And even the first couple of weeks this year, I think I'm like slightly plus, but it's been slow. And usually the first few weeks of college football are big for me. So early on, I think it helped that I saw I was winning. And that was probably the main push then at the time when I was a little less mature and less knowledgeable, where I was like, well, I'm winning, so I just got to keep doing this. And like I mentioned from poker, I had actual money that I could put towards it, where I wasn't just betting like $20 a game, which ends up being pretty insignificant. I was able to actually put maybe $300 or $400 a game on a college football game. And if I'm betting, you know, 20 a week or something, you know, that goes a pretty far way. So that was probably the main thing where I was like, man, I'm making money doing this. I need to be putting more money into this and more time into it too, because I know I can become better. And then I think becoming more knowledgeable and just, I guess, understanding of everything, I realized, you know, hitting at that rate for two seasons in a row isn't sustainable. You know, 55% might be, especially if you're hitting into stuff earlier in the week and whatnot. And if I'm, you know, hitting 55%, that's still fantastic. And that's something that's attainable. But at that point, your ROI is obviously smaller. But if you're betting more, then your profitability is going to be higher. So it turned into more of this game after a few years where I realized, hey, I'm probably not going to be able to just hit like 60%. That was pretty nice that I was fortunate my first couple of seasons hitting at that rate. But I need to get more money into this and know that I can probably hit 55% or so regularly. And so that's what I've been doing the last few years, is betting a lot more per game. Getting in touch with people that can help me get down a lot more per game has been really helpful, and having that kind of organized on the side. But ultimately, I think it was, as far as your question goes, me actually winning that got me excited and putting more time into it from the get-go. And then me recognizing down the road, hey, I kind of was lucky and fortunate early on. There's a lot more to learn. And now that I have, I'm able to kind of grasp it all better.
Yeah. And so the second question in that sequence, it ties it into the last one we were talking about. I don't know where you were in like your dating or married life at that point, but if there was other people that were also depending on your income, how receptive were they to that idea?
Sure. So I was, tie back in my association with the Mormon Church, I did a, if you know any Mormons, if you knew any, or maybe your wife does or whatever, they do this church mission thing. A lot of the guys do once they turn 19.
Sure.
They go and the guys in the suits and ties or on the bikes with the little tags, they go and do that. So I actually did that for 2 years in Portugal. So I dropped everything after my sophomore year of college and playing cards and everything at the time. It would have been like in 2007. And I left for 2 years, went and lived in Portugal, learned the language. I'm fluent in Portuguese now, but I got to go and serve the people there in Portugal, which was fantastic. I'd do it, you know, again, 100 times out of 100. That ended up, kind of pushing a lot of stuff back, where when I got back, I was 21 and a half years old, and then still had a lot more college to do, my undergrad. And then there was a lot had changed even from a card standpoint, where for 2 years, I didn't play poker at all. And the game evolved dramatically. And I had to do some adapting in that regard too, which was actually a lot of fun, kind of coming back almost like, you know, oblivious to what happened for 2 years, thinking I could play one way still and be profitable, and realizing that everyone else was playing a similar way and kind of having to get ahead of the game again. I dated who's my wife now actually before I even left for Portugal. So when I got back, she was still single. And so we'd just been in touch the whole time. We'd write, talked on the phone, I think once or twice. But ultimately, when I got back, we started dating again, eventually got married. But she's kind of just been in on this the entire time, which has been helpful. And she's been really supportive. Otherwise, if it was like, hey, some random girl, well, what do you do? Oh, I play poker online and go to school, or I'm betting on sports. Like, I definitely, that would be a thing to try to, like, you know, figure out and mend and make work. So I fortunately didn't really have to go through that, because she was already kind of associated with me from the get-go with everything since I was, you know, 18 years old, basically. So I think I lucked out in that regard, and she's been supportive. And while I was finishing school, she, you know, we didn't have kids yet or anything until more recently, and she had a job and, you know, was working and where I was living. I did my master's degree was at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. So we were living there, and she was able to work, which helped obviously bringing in income too and stuff. So we've been blessed in that regard, I guess, as a family, a young family, and trying to get things going with betting. But I didn't have to really convince her or her family or anything, you know, hey, this is what I do, and try to swoon her that way. It just kind of was all part of the package, and she knew me that way from the start.
Sure. I do want to talk about the impact of the legalization of sports betting that it's had, and whatever insight you can provide from your perspective in sports betting. I want to lead that conversation with a question that I actually, back when, like, what'd you call it? I think you called it the call-in podcast that you did with VSiN for a little bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is that right? Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I actually called the call-in podcast and asked this very question. I'm going to ask you it again here for my listeners to hear.
Okay.
If you learned that, like, Iowa legalized sports betting, or Indiana, so a state that's not New Jersey, Pennsylvania, or Delaware, right? So maybe a little more obscure state, legalized sports betting, and their book is offering some pretty good lines at -103. Would that sort of deal tempt you to relocate to take advantage of?
I remember this question now, so I didn't realize that was actually you until you brought it up. But I'm pretty sure I ultimately said something to the notion of it wouldn't. I'm not sure if – I don't think my mind's changed. So what's nice – so a lot of the betting I do, even though I do live in Las Vegas, a good portion of my actual money that gets down isn't in Las Vegas anyways, and it's around the country or world. And so that's helpful. It doesn't matter where I live, really, with technology and the internet these days. It's like cliche to say, but it really is true. You don't really have to be in any one location. It helps being in Vegas. It would maybe help living in a state, say Iowa, if they really were offering -103 and offering limits that were more than, say, like, you know, just $500 or something. Then, you know, I'd probably have to consider it, or at least hire someone to be living there, getting down for me. If I didn't want to move to Iowa, which is probably the case, New York maybe is different. Maybe I'd move to New York or Florida or something, but and I'm from California. You know, once they legalize things, I imagine that's, you know, in the script here in the future, you know, maybe I'll end up down there. But -103 would be fantastic. I don't think people, you know, people listening, maybe some do realize, but the difference between -103 and -110 is pretty drastic. You know, -110, you need to be able to pick 52.3% more or less to break even. And I think a lot of people could just, and the bankroll management thing's so big because I think a lot of recreational bettors, that's kind of what hinders them as they change and vary their bet sizing just kind of randomly or based on what's happened the last few bets that they've made. So they're either chasing or betting too big because they've been losing, or maybe they're betting games they wouldn't have because they've been hot and then they lose those ones. But at -103, I mean, I think most recreational people, if they're following sports and feel like they're smart enough and just disciplined, can probably hit about 51%. In break even. And so you'd think, like, if at -103, that'd be about a break even player, maybe even slightly profitable. So that goes a long way, saving 7 cents every time you lose. So it's definitely enticing. It's a good question. I just think ultimately you'd be able to probably get down on -103 the most you could, no matter where you live, just because of the setup we have with technology, internet, and connections and stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, so with that, the follow-up to that is, I guess, has there been any blip of change in the action you can get, the lines that you're getting, whatever it may be, since SCOTUS made this decision and some states on the East Coast have legalized sports betting? Have you noticed any change in what's available to you?
It's a good question to bring up, because so I personally haven't noticed anything outside of people in other states are betting really mispriced or badly juiced or bad vig numbers, and which isn't good. And so it's, I don't want to bash on legality potentially in all these states, because it's a really positive thing for me, for a lot of people, right? The entire industry, it's really good. But then they came out and from the get-go you saw, so I'm not going to use names for companies, but people know who they are, but they're, the vig would be like -118 both ways, or they'd have golf matchups that were like -300 +150 and tie +900 or something like just ridiculous splits. That's just impossible to beat. Like, it really is. And we're talking, like I said, we're 7 cents from -103 to -110. So drastic. You go to -118. It's the best of the world is in a big market, like betting the NFL. That would not be beatable for the best. The -110 is, -118 is about where probably they'd be break even. And so that's pretty bad in the sense that nothing's changed, because there's not really any competition yet. So I hope you're right in your kind of scope of there'll be -103 in a state down the road, because there needs to be something that drives competition between the states. And that would be awesome, right? And, you know, maybe it is something that we'll see down the road. But for now, I haven't seen much change, because the best prices I can get are either in Vegas or offshore with, you know, other potential suitors that are, you know, booking games and stuff. So for now, I don't think there's been much change. I think it's going to be a really long process, and that eventually we'll see a lot of change from the actual betting standpoint. I think the biggest change, to give you one though, that I have noticed, is just the media stuff. There's so many, and even people like VSiN and Gil and everyone there just anticipating the drop from you know, the ban on sports betting in all the states, and they saw it coming a couple of years ago, and other, you know, avenues have, other sites have, even the fantasy site I'm doing stuff with at Fantasy Guru Elite. I mean, they're a DFS site, but now they're trying to add sports betting content, which is good. They're trying to pursue it. You know, some networks have started doing new shows. Like, that type of thing is going to be more and more common for sure. And I've seen a change there in people trying to bring the betting content to the masses. But as far as like actual betting goes, my processes haven't changed at all yet.
Good. And not with the betting content is in heavy flow, and also the quote unquote experts or even touts, I'll even go as far as saying that, are popping up a little bit more now with people claiming to have insights or expertise or analysis or even just plain luck that is marketable to bettors that are looking for a little bit of guidance. How dangerous do you think this could be moving forward as the industry continues to grow and it becomes a more accepted thing in our nation?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been there, you know, before, but it'll obviously compound now as every state starts legalizing things and more people realize, hey, I'm allowed to bet on sports now. Well, I'm going to give it a try. They're going to look for information, whether it be, you know, via radio, TV, or just social media stuff. And I think ultimately it comes down to the person trying to make the decisions and ultimately putting in the bets. But I mean, just if you're reading someone, you got to try to just be smart about it. If they're not making sense, or they're telling you that the last 12 MAC games have gone over the total on Wednesday nights in October, like, you got to realize there's certain things that actually pertain to the game you're about to bet, and things that aren't. And there's going to be people spewing random information, like you're saying, whether they're touts or not. There's just going to be people trying to guide others. And it's going to be important for people that are using that information to be able to, you know, discern it and make hopefully, you know, better bets because of it, rather than getting caught and, you know, whoever it may be that's leading them astray. So it's tough to comment on for now, because I don't think it's exploded quite to the point where we're going to see it in probably like 2 to 3 years. And my guess is a good portion of the states will be legalized, and then it'll just be, you know, full on craziness and hecticness. And hopefully people are smart enough to kind of realize, all right, this person is making some sense, this person isn't. They can catch people that are lying or deleting tweets, or like, there's little things where it's just pretty evident that, okay, there's something scammy going on here. Not everyone will be able to do that. So there's going to be some people that get taken advantage of for sure, which is too bad. But ultimately it's going to be, you know, up to their decisions and hopefully doing it in a way that doesn't cost them too much down the road. But I think it's good to bring up in a podcast, or just to address is the word I was looking for, just like you're doing now, because if people are aware of it before maybe they even attack betting more regularly down the road, then, you know, they're at least a little more aware and smarter going into it.
Yeah. As I've tried to emphasize, since I had the honor of actually being in the Supreme Court when that case was being heard, I was there as VSiN's correspondent, and as soon as the decision was announced, I emphasized it here on this podcast that just because someone is a sports expert, and they may be an expert in sports, doesn't mean they know how to bet on it. And those two things, being able to tell you who's going to win and who's going to cover and why, are two. Maybe in the Venn diagram, there's some overlap, but they're still two different things. So always important to keep that in mind. Preston, I have one last question for you. Play a little game here called Bet Your Life on It. I'm going to give you two questions, and you're hypothetically going to bet your life on it. Of course, no one's going to collect. If you were to lose the bets, of course, you would lose your life. But if you were to win, you'd be granted an entire second lifetime. And of course, this is only hypothetical. I'm not going to come knocking on your door if anything goes awry. But simply for emphasizing the importance of the decision, and I think this is fitting because I think this is the last time I'm going to ask this particular question for this segment. In the state of Utah, do you think the state of Utah will see a legal weed dispensary or a legal casino? Which will the state of Utah see first?
So this is a one or the other question.
One or the other. Yep. If I told you one of those things came first, which side would you hypothetically bet your life on?
I would probably bet my life. Oh man, that's actually really close. Have you been using the Utah example with everyone?
So I ask it about 5 to 7 or 8 times, and because I usually like I record sort of in waves, and so I usually have a question that I ask every few weeks. So it's and I don't know the exact tally right now. I need to update it, but I'll tell you it's close. It's pretty close.
This is my best guess. For people that aren't aware, so Utah's predominantly LDS or Mormon. There's a lot of Mormons in Utah, and it's a really conservative state, and a lot of the church is tied in. Not a lot, but a good portion is tied in politically to what's being done there. And both were pretty big, like not going to happen for a while is my guess. But which one would be first is it's not going to be look at all the money these casinos could bring you that's going to sway them. It's going to be something to look at the good, you know, uses and side effects or potential health benefits of weed or marijuana. And that, I think, is what I would go with first, because I could see church leaders or politicians in Utah buying into that before greed and money and, you know, casino life. So I'm going to go with the dispensary first if I had to bet my life on it.
Yep. I'm with you. I lean that side as well. And I think you'll be the last time I ask that question. So I'll go back and check the tally to see what actually won. Preston Johnson, you are at Sports Cheetah on Twitter. You can be found on Friday mornings doing the 3-on-3 with Gil Alexander on a numbers game. I know you do your own podcast, right?
Yeah, I do, actually. We just switched. If you don't mind me, I'll plug it real quick. I just fired it up again. We take phone calls still. It's not called the Call-In Podcast anymore. We call it A Petty Moose. You can call in Monday nights. We rent out the ESPN studio here in Las Vegas, me and a buddy of mine, Matt Lindemann, who works for Caesars, actually. And we take your calls, talk about games, talk about maybe bad beats from the weekend, and discuss, you know, just some of the bets that we're looking at making during the week, too. And it's going to be heavily college football related right now, but we'll start throwing in college hoops, NBA. Basketball is actually my favorite sport, period, to watch, follow, play. So it's a lot of fun, and, you know, gets everyone else involved who has questions they can call into the show.
Yeah, very well. Preston, thanks so much for your time. I did appreciate talking to you and learning about you as a gambler.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you having me on. You guys have a good one.
Again, big thanks to Preston for joining us. As most of you know, USC only won by 3 points, so they did not cover the 3.5 that they were at in the game that Preston and I were talking about. But still, Preston's going to look at that game as a positive equity play, a positive EV play, because he beat the closing line. I think it closed at 4.5, right? So there was a point of value in there. So he sees 3.5 is the line. He has the line. He believes the line should be somewhere around 6 or 7. He sees value in that. He makes that wager. And then not only did he make a bet where he saw value between what the line was and what he thought it should be, but the line did move in his favor, and he got a point of value there. So while the bet didn't succeed, it's still viewed positively in that manner. Again, you can go to thebetterlife.us/merch and buy into the Survivor Pool that will be starting in week 4. You have until 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursday to complete that transaction to get invited in. Patreon.com/thebetterlife is where you can support the show. On Mondays, I put out my bonus audio on how I feel about the new NFL lines for that coming week, which games I would completely avoid in Survivor, etc. Patreon.com/thebetterlife. Tip your dealers, tip your cocktail waitress, and tip your favorite podcast host. I am on Twitter @thebetterlife, on Instagram @thebetterlife. Technically at facebook.com/thebetterlife, I think. We have a Facebook page. I just sort of post the show and informational stuff on there right now. I'm not too engaging on there. I'm going to admit that right off the bat. But if that page grows, I'll get a little bit more involved. And lastly, I want to thank everybody for taking the time to listen. I think that's going to wrap up this show. I will see you next week with an interesting look at tracking gambling. That's going to be the theme. That's going to be the subject of next week's show. Going to talk to a couple people that we respect in this community. They may or may not be named Mark Duvall and Eric Rosenthal. Going to talk about tracking gambling. gambling. Super important when it comes to when you want to really manage your gambling habits. You can only manage what you measure, and they both have different perspectives. In fact, all three of us have different approaches to what we track, why we track it, and so somewhere in the mix of all that, you're going to find something that maybe resonates with you and what your goals are. So we will see you next week. I'm Timothy Lawson. Good night. Good luck.